Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Well, good morning, Mike. After we chatted last week, we followed up a little bit after the episode, and I know quite a few more things came to mind that we may have missed. So it felt like we were diving in pretty deep. And one of the things I love about thinking through the four chapter gospel is realizing just how much it touches. So let's kick it off here by starting with what things came to you after we talked last week that might be relevant to the four chapter gospel there.
Yeah, that's a great question. We forgot things like you walked out of the house wearing some clothes, I hope.
Don't know that for sure.
You're taking a shower. And in fact, let me back it all the way out to just remembering C.S. Lewis and why he said he was a Christian and why he believed in the gospel. And he has that famous line where he says, "I believe in the gospel as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but by it, I see everything else." So what I appreciate about the four chapter gospel is you don't see some things, you see everything else. And so I think after our podcast last time, I realized, oh, there's a number of things we forgot. And let me start with one is, did you enjoy a nice warm shower?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, that would be a podcast just in and of itself, but I've done an exercise before with businesses where we ask them, if you enjoyed a warm shower, write down all the institutions that were necessary for that to happen. So they begin to realize, well, hot water heater, then you have to have reliable electricity, and then you have to have, that has to be certified by, installed by electricians and certified by certifying institutions, and the same with water delivery. My whole point in that exercise is that as Christians, when we go to the developing world, we often don't think institutions. So we might come into a town of 20 or 30,000 and be overjoyed that we put in a well, which if you don't have a well, is wonderful. But then we move on to the next one and the next town, without realizing that if you lived in a town like Annapolis and we all had to wake up every morning and go down to City Dock and all gather around the well, we would say, this is not what we'd call a flourishing town. And so the four chapter gospel even challenges some of our notions about what is flourishing and what ought we to be striving for in the developing world. And that begins even with a shower. And so the shower you enjoyed, believe it or not, goes all the way back to ordering everything and improving everything is why God put them in the garden. And the Christian tradition is a triune God. The triune God is really emblematic of an institution because institutions transcend individuals. As we believe in three persons sharing one nature. God is a triune God. So that's where in the Western tradition of institutional thinking comes out of the Christian faith. And it's why we in the West that have been very influenced by the Christian tradition enjoy a warm shower. So you had a warm shower, and a lot of that goes back to the four chapter gospel. And also, did you walk out buck naked, or were you wearing clothes?
When I left the house?
Yeah.
I was fully clothed.
Okay. In your right mind?
That I don't know.
Anyway, so I'll have some fun with you. Why were you wearing clothing?
Well, societally, that is a norm. So, from a certain perspective, that's an important piece. I think one, from a temperature perspective, especially these past couple mornings, it's been a little bit chilly. So I've needed some warmth, some extra layers there. Maybe this goes back to social norms, but it is not comfortable to be naked outside of your home, you know. Some people prefer that, but by far not the average individual.
Yeah, so that, you know, we're having some fun here, but the 4-chapter gospel, when we begin in Genesis, we first thing we remember is, oh, Adam and Eve were naked.
Yeah.
And they were not ashamed. And so the fact that we put on clothing tells us it reminds us, first of all, we're in a fallen world. And second, it also tells us there must have been some sort of atmospheric changes with the fall. And because the fact of the matter is, or unless God's plan was for all of us to live somewhere in the Mideast where the temperature was uniform, but as Minnesota as it is these days, you really couldn't be naked and unashamed. You'd be naked and dead. So it tells us there are probably some atmosphere changes. And then clothing reminds us also about modesty. Because that's part of our tradition also, we were to adorn ourselves, but with modesty. And I think what's meant there is another aspect of the 4-chapter gospel reminds us, and clothing reminds us of, is what do we clothe? Now, in the winter and the fall, I know I'm going to work and what have you, there's professional codes. But think about when you go to the beach. This is, again, a whole other topic for another time, but we cover what we call our private parts. And why are they called our private parts? So this is another podcast for another time, but it's been long held by many traditions that the gospel is best told in our body, particularly in our sexuality as male and female, and most specifically in our genitalia. And so we will have a podcast in the future that will take on this entire subject, that there's a theology in our physical body. And the fact that when you go to the beach, Pat, my bet is you don't put on a skull cap and consider that you're appropriately covered.
We should hope not.
We should hope not. But in fact, what you cover denotes something very powerful about those parts of your body that are telling something that are very powerful and mystical and spiritual. And even though people aren't aware of that, I remember all the way back to when Janet Jackson had the wardrobe malfunction in the Super Bowl halftime show, and she instinctively, without thinking twice, reached to cover it because her intuition was, this ought to be covered, and in that setting. And so this is telling us something. Clothing is telling us something, all the way down to when you go to the beach and ask yourself, why are these called private parts? And in fact, the female body and the male body, the parts that most deeply tell of God's love and his desire to expand the circle of love, are told in our genitalia. And so not only were you covered when you went to work, you made sure you have covered those parts of your body.
I'm thinking, it may be a good time to kind of walk this path a little bit, but I'm curious, as we see sort of not an unraveling, but to an extent, that standard has gotten looser and looser today. What we show has become more and more free. And obviously with the rise of the internet and issues within pornography, you see a lot of these distortions of that. But you sort of, you see again, a sort of an embraced sense of freedom. Obviously you have the sexual revolution as well in recent history. And so what's the distortion there? And does that speak to clothes, right? If one stance could be, well, in the garden, we were all naked, as you said. And so therefore we should be renewed back to nakedness. I think that the argument against that could be, yeah, but we were meant to improve upon. But sort of flushing out, if we had never fallen, what does that look like?
That's right. I think, first of all, had we never fallen, because remember, the first clothier,
right,
first person to fashion clothing was God, and he did it in response to cover their private parts, in response to them having fallen in sin. And so I think that the covering is exactly what happens throughout the cosmos, if you want to put it that way, because the gospel is uncovering what's already there. The gospel is discovering that God is present in the entirety of reality, and yet sin has put this dust coating or a dirt coating over the entire thing. It hasn't wrecked the universe, hasn't wrecked our bodies, but it has covered it. And so for God to cover them has a lot to say about what happens when we sin, and what should be objects of desire often now become objects of lust. And lust is what happens when desire goes south. Lust is the corruption of something good. So all sin, Pat, in another point I think that's brought out beautifully in the four chapter gospel, is that all sin is a corruption of a good or some good things. In other words, God created all things, but he didn't create sin. Sin is a corruption of good things, just like rust on a car is a corruption of iron and oxide. Just about the only thing I remember from my chemistry class. But iron is inherently good and oxygen is inherently good, but you put them together in a bastard combination. That's what bastard means. It means illegitimate. You put them together in a bastard combination and you have rust. So sin is the bastard combination of it's the disordered desires, and that's what the Bible calls lust. And the problem with lust is an unquenchable fire. And an unquenchable fire is what drives pornography. It's what drives a desire to see parts of the body that ought to be private. And yet it's an unquenchable, it's a thirst that can never be slaked. So you have all sorts of revolutions in clothing all through the years, all the way down to the tight corset and the flattening of the breasts by some, you know, movements to absolutely quench the, slake the desire, the lust, rather. I don't think they work. I'm certainly not pro, let it all hang out. But the fact of the matter is that the imagination can go right through a corset, and
sure,
lust can burn through any of these. So it's the making of clothing was to cover, and yet at the same time, there are those who suggest that, especially with the great flood, that in Noah's time, that with the heavens burst and what have you, there might have been a canopy, and a canopy over the earth would have created uniform temperatures. And now, with the breaking of that canopy, you have variations around the planet of temperatures. And so the clothing that they have becomes more and more they develop it. They do improve it. Now, what that tells you, Pat, it's back to your point. In the garden, God says improve it. There's no clothing to improve upon, but after the fall, there is covering to improve upon, and hence you have the beginning of a whole clothing industry. They do improve on it as time goes on, with conflicting notions about why do we have clothing?
Right,
so you have products of paying people wearing as least as they can, even nudist colonies, all the way up to cover everything right up around the neck. In fact, you have traditions today for the female, particularly, you cover everything but the eyes.
Well, you know what that brings to mind, the first clothing, so to speak, right? It was a result of sin, like you said, and it was made out of animals, right?
Yeah, it's like the food industry. We're going back. Maybe we should go back to plant based food.
Well,
clothing.
It's what's interesting is you have that sacrifice, and then God made clothing out of that sacrifice, and I don't think it would be too far of a stretch to say, well, why do we have clothing? You could go the route and say, oh, it's just a result of sin. We shouldn't have it, right? Maybe a little extreme. But I think you could also say we have clothing as a reminder that our bodies must be covered, both physically and spiritually. And so clothing could actually be this reminder every morning I put on clothes that I am equally covered by the grace and sacrifice of the cross. And so just as when I get in the shower this morning, I mean, when I went down that exercise with you years ago, it literally changed how I take showers, where now every single time I'm in that hot water, I realize not everyone else gets this, but this is just an incredible experience. And I just so happen to be born in a country that has it, happen to be in a county that has healthy and clean water, happen to be in a time period of life and of sort of the history of the world that actually has this so common. And I sit there and just enjoy the goodness of God's creation. And it's a shower. It's 10 minutes of my day, but it really is incredible. And it's because, again, that enrichment of, wow, I no longer take this for granted. And I think clothing can also be that. It can be a reminder that I don't take for granted Christ's sacrifice on the cross, because this clothing originated. It's almost a precursor, a foreshadowing, right, of that sacrifice to come on the cross.
I think so. That's terrific. I hadn't really thought about this before, and you might have explained why one of our kids, when we'll leave up this person's name, was in high school, enjoyed 30, 40-minute showers. Gosh, I never thought maybe in the shower really appreciating God.
Oh, man. In high school, maybe. Unlikely.
I think what you said is, I appreciate it because I think you there's a connection there with why we celebrate the Eucharist in the same way, because you have a bodily sacrifice, and it is a combination of joy, solemnity, it's called, and also gratefulness when it's appropriately celebrated. It's all those things, and so the Bible does often speak that because of that we've been clothed in righteousness. So many of the metaphors, some of the metaphors in the Bible do pick up on clothing, and it is a virtuous thing, just as God clothing the Adam and Eve, covering them, was virtuous. But gosh, you may be onto something, Pat, that if we really want to follow God, we go back to plant-based clothing. Wear it and then eat it.
There you go. So,
okay, well, I'm going to push on with your day because I have an idea here. I think you picked up some things and put them in your pockets as you were walking out to your car.
Yep, sure. So cell phone, wallet, keys, the usual check.
All right, let's start with the last Shelby first. Keys. Why'd you pick up keys?
I need them for my car.
What does the 4-chapter gospel tell you why you had keys?
my keys, you could argue, is sort of symbolic of dominion, but it gives me full dominion over my car, my vehicle. As soon as I put the key in, hopefully it responds.
That's right. So it's not sort of, it is.
Mm.
You living out the cultural mandate, let them have dominion. In other words, if we didn't believe in that, your car wouldn't have a key, wouldn't be operated by a key. It would be like a Willy's Jeep in World War II, where operated by you push a button. Because in war, they couldn't afford the luxury of, where are the keys to the Jeep?
Yeah, so I'm exercising dominion first thing in the morning.
Dominion. And by the way, even that button on that Jeep is exercising dominion. It's sure. Just simply offering dominion to a wider array of people, soldiers, whereas your keys are telling you, first of all, dominion, but the four chapter gospel, they're also reminding you of the fall.
Yeah, because without keys, anyone could take my vehicle.
Yeah, so you actually do recognize someone could take this car. In fact, what else is on your keychain?
Home key, right? Key to our house.
And again, that gives you dominion, chapter one of the gospel, creation. It recognizes the fall. We don't want intruders at night. It recognizes redemption. Well, what can be done about that? Keys and locks. Isn't it fascinating that Jesus said, I'm giving you the keys to the kingdom?
Yeah.
We are supposed to be exercising dominion in bringing thy kingdom come to the earth in every nook and cranny of creation. That's what a gospel, four chapter gospel, the breadth of this gospel is, it goes well beyond we need to befriend our neighbors, share the gospel, have them come to Christ, get them in a small group, train them to share the faith, lead others to faith, attend church, tithe, pray, study your Bible, and work hard and go to heaven. Now, every one of those things, by the way, is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They just are way too limiting on the scope. Because we are all the way out to each end of the universe in the four chapter gospel. I've joked with my wife that our part of our dream for a flourishing town, we live in Annapolis, would be that we don't lock our doors at night.
Well, I mean, yeah, in a lot of ways that used to be the norm, and in a lot of rural areas that still is.
That is, isn't that true?
Yeah.
Well, the keys, and you said you had some other things you stuffed in your pockets?
Cell phone.
How does a four-chapter gospel tell you? It tells you a bunch about your cell phone, but if you start in creation, what does it tell you?
Well, first, technology is not inherently bad. We are to improve. So the cell phone by itself is not a bad thing. Technology by itself is not a bad thing.
So what is what's the technology here that this is trying to improve on?
Well, the smartphone, that's debatable. But with a cell phone, the origin of the idea was communication.
And where does that come from?
God spoke to Adam.
It even predates that.
God's
technically not the right word when you say predates. You can go all the way back into eternity. True. What do we know about the triune God?
He conversed. He had a relationship with himself in three persons.
That's right.
Yeah.
We don't know. You know, when you do a podcast, you lose control as to where does this thing go? So this thing can go around the world. Well, I think it's fair to say to my friends of the Islamic faith, I've asked them this question. Allah is great. Allah is one. Who did Allah talk to for eternity before creation?
There's no answer to that, right?
I don't. I'm yet to have one. Maybe there is. Maybe there's an Islamic scholar who will hear this podcast and get in touch with me, and I'd be happy to have that conversation. Because as best as I can tell, if you're talking to no one, then you would create beings who, by their very nature, would talk to no one. Or if he's talking to himself, there are people who would consider that to be, well, we don't mean to be insulting. But the fact of the matter is, we're made in the image of the triune God, who have for eternity enjoyed one another, loved one another, and communicated. And we know they didn't communicate in English or Hebrew or Greek. We don't know the language. That's not the point. But it was a language because in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He spoke. And so the Hebrew word for God is Elohim, plural. True, someone could say Elohim does at times denote royalty, but it also denotes plurality. So the mystery in Genesis 1, in the four-chapter gospel, is immediately in this world at that time when readers or hearers would have been considering all these world religions, all these gods, gods of sun, moon, stars, light, darkness. Here comes a story that says, in the beginning, Elohim, whoa, Elohim? Like multiple gods or what? Created everything you're seeing. Created it all. There aren't many, many gods. There is one God, multiple persons. Let us make them in our, see all the plurals, image. So the fact that we have improved our communication goes back to the triune God has communicated from since eternity past, communicates to create. And yes, to your point, communicates this to Adam. So we're made to talk and communicate. And Adam sees Eve, he communicates. He doesn't give her the silent treatment. That's typical male today. How was your day? Fine. He looks at her, Shazam, Zowie, this is bone in my bone, flesh in my flesh. Holy Smokies, come here, give me a kiss, da da da. I'm making some of this stuff up. But I think that's inherent. And it's even why when we thought about this podcast, Pat, I invited you to join me. I felt that we would do better than I would do, that we're more made for a we conversation than listening to some talking head. And so our communication technologies are just delivery systems for things that we desire. And we desire to communicate. And I have to tell you, I go to a fair number of conferences, I guess. And what I've noticed is when we most image God is not when you have the speaker talking. It's when they say we're going to take a 15-minute break, and after 20 minutes, they're still trying to rope everyone in. It's because they're really more manifesting the image of God during the break, talking to one another, than they are manifesting the image of God sitting there listening to one person.
Sure, yeah.
They're enjoying the break far more often than they are listening to the lecture.
Yeah, yeah. No, the fellowship of that, the time together, even the networking piece. Yeah.
So your phone is the logical extension of the triune God communicating eternally, continuously. The only challenge in our fallen world is we don't know what's newsworthy and what ought to be communicated versus simply throw out a blizzard of communication.
Yeah, well said. Well said. We hit on that a little bit last week. We could probably dive further in a whole another hour's worth of a conversation.
Well, you had something in your back pocket, though, you were mentioning.
Yeah, wallet.
Wallet. What's that all about?
That contains my ID, my driver's license, right? That contains usually some credit cards in there, possibly some cash. Yeah.
So someone told me, I've not checked this out. So listeners, you can tell us one way or another. Someone told me once that ID comes from Imago Dei. I don't know if that's true or not, but we're made in the image of God. So what your driver's license is telling you, first of all, that it might be telling you, you know, we are made, each one of us, uniquely made in the image of God. It's also giving you dominion.
Sure. Yeah, I have the ability to drive legally with that. Yeah.
We actually don't have the ability.
That's true. That's true. The
what did the driver's license give you?
What's the right word?
Well, dominion is another word. Dominion is gives you the authority.
Legal
authority. So you can still, you're still capable of driving, but you do not have the legal authority. And now we're back to what we talked about our last time together, that the driver's license is saying, here's someone who ought to drive. We go back to chapter one in the gospel. Creation is our, you know, how we imagine things ought to be. And the general rule in societies is you ought to be qualified to operate certain kinds of equipment, and you get licenses. And so again, we're back to, this is dominion. This is authority. It's, so there's your driver's license. And you also have what else?
That's some cash in there. An ability to pay for things, whether that's credit card or cash.
Cool. You've got actual literal cash.
Yeah, I know, right? Old school.
How old are you?
Usually it's like a 5 or 10. You never know. You know, you never know when you may need that.
That's right. So Niall Ferguson, who's over there at Oxford, and he's done some PBS. Niall Ferguson would be fun for some of our listeners, but he's written some good books on money, institutions. The ascent of money is one of them. And so it's the whole notion that it's difficult to have dominion. That's the language we would use. Year round, if, for example, you're a farmer. And so you have to come up with some sort of barter system. Barter becomes difficult also. So then you have to have some kind of representative authority or dominion. And that's the rise of money. So you know that this paper, this coin, is backed by something that is desirable, gold in our case, and it represents value attached to commodities or merchandise or things that you want to purchase, or credit that you want to take out. So what else is in your wallet?
Besides ID and credit?
Yeah, credit cards.
Right.
And so credit cards are ways, again, of extending your dominion or your authority, because you, simplest notion would be, if you are a farmer and you know this crop is coming in, it's going to bring these kind of revenues, but you need some of these revenues today, you take a loan against those, and that crop is collateral. And all of this came out of particularly well-developed in the monastic system. And then almost brought to perfection by the Medicis and the Medicis. But today it's what's called banking and finance. And that all comes out of the fourth chapter gospel. And your credit card is the touch point for you. Or today, obviously, your smartphone is the touch point for you. And the those who develop the technologies take a certain cut to be able to afford that technology, and their profitability is in that having that device. And so even Apple is trying to get in on all of these various banking things beyond just Apple Pay. But your credit cards and your phone remind us of the gospel. Even if it goes from one end to the other, it does involve finance.
Yeah, and I like similar to clothing, it is a reminder of the four chapters, right? What we're not saying is, oh yeah, credit card's a reminder of the gospel and therefore it's great. We are saying it is equally a reminder of the goodness of creation, the fact that we have fallen, so we need to hold these things together. That sort of solemn reflection that you mentioned earlier, even with the Eucharist, I think we can apply that to the same ordinary things of our clothing, like you said, is a reminder of sacrifice, of credit cards, of keys, the reminder that this has been restored, dominion has been restored to an extent, but there is still a fallen world where people still want to steal cars and to ride away with them, and that is saddening, but also there's an element of restoration there.
Yeah, that's a great point, Pat, and for people listening in on this, I don't want them to think this is some kind of esoteric 35,000 foot conversation. The fact of the matter is, you by the way, you left a house, so the four chapter gospel helps us understand house and why we long for that. And Jesus even says, "In my Father's house, many rooms. I'm preparing a place for you." It's kind of coded into us, but the four-chapter gospel does this. The two chapters starts with the fall and then what can be done about the fall. So if you think of the gospel as ought, is, can, will, that is creation is causes everyone to imagine the way the world ought to be. The fall is a recognition it's not the way it ought to be. Redemption is what God could do. So we think of what can be done. And then God has placed eternity in our hearts, so we dream about what will be. The creation, fall, redemption, restoration gospel is heard on the street as ought, is, can, will. But if you only know this fall, redemption gospel, you're going to tend to think, well, this is the way it is, but what can I do about it? And when it comes to, for example, going to college. Well, what is my situation right now? I don't have any money. Well, what can I do? I can borrow. So I'm going to take out loans to go to college. The average college student, as I understand it now, comes out of college with roughly $28,000 to $30,000 in debt. We know of students that have been 80, 90. I met a dentist who came out, I believe he's a $250,000 in loans. So what am I getting at? What I'm getting at is what technologies always tell you what they can do, but they never tell us what they will undo regarding what the world ought to be. And so in the four chapter gospel, there's such a thing as modesty, for example, in clothing. So it's not just, what kind of clothes can we make? Rather, it takes in this tension, what clothing, sort of clothing ought we to wear? Now, over in finance, it's not a matter of, so how much debt can I leverage to get into this home? Because there is in the Christian tradition an appreciation for a spiritual discipline called frugality. Now, for most Western Americans, you almost have to spell that word because they don't know what frugality means. Just as in modesty is in some way holds in tension what clothing ought to be, yet what we can do, frugality holds in tension. Yes, you can borrow up to 33 times your earnings, but ought you? I use 33 because in the 08 housing crash, financial institutions, Fannie Mae, Sallie Mae, had leveraged up to 33 times their assets in debt. In other words, they were way out over the tip of their skis because they were trusting this slope goes way down. We're going to gather a lot of speed. We're going to make a lot of money. We have a long way to go on this. This is a great ride. And they didn't see the ground rushing up to them. Smash. So I think we have been HGTV'd into a whole new set of expectations about where we ought, the level of living and housing we ought to have. And I say HGTV because, first of all, we watch it a lot, poking them in the eye. But the fact of the matter is, Kathy and I have been married 38 years. First house we lived in that we rented, I don't remember us walking in and saying, oh my gosh, we can't cook in this kitchen. Oh, and those countertops, gotta go. They ain't granite.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And somehow we were in there as a very small cottage, very small kitchen. But we don't hear ourselves anymore. When I hear people say, oh, we can't cook in there, I want to go, excuse me, you mean the stove doesn't work? You mean that you're 5'4" and the physical space you inhabit makes it physically impossible for anybody else to be in that kitchen at that time? So you can see that when you don't have a gospel that starts with ought, you're saying what you can and can't do, and you're nuts. You're really nuts. And there are people who we are heading right back into that same situation we had before 08. I don't know what's going to happen. That's not my point. But you had people who don't understand what housing ought to be, what debt ought to be. I'm not opposed to debt. But and then you have just gross consumption in the United States, gross consumption. And the Council of Philanthropy says the average American, this includes Christians, gives 3%. And you know why, Pat? It's because that's all they can do. 97% of their income is spoken for. And so we have debted ourselves up to such a degree that I know a few pastors, and they say, you know, I'm going to do something on giving or tithing or generosity. I want to say to them, good luck.
Yeah.
Because you can't give out of thin air. If you have 97% of your income spoken for, you're trying to squeeze blood out of a turnip, buddy.
Well, Mike, you've made an interesting transition here because we've been talking about the gospel in regards to all it is can will, creation, fall, redemption, restoration. And from a Christian perspective, we've been saying, well, the is can gospel, right? The two chapters there, that piece sort of gives you a notion of life that I should recognize my sin and accept Jesus and then get other people to accept Jesus. That's the extent of my sort of path here. And love God along the way, all those things, reading the Bible, all those things, yes, but it is a truncated gospel in that does not give me understanding of why I'm putting on clothes. It doesn't give me understanding of why I'm getting a shower. It doesn't give me understanding of why I'm driving my car to work. But the transition you've made here is that not only are we talking about a Christian thing of we are embracing a truncated gospel, but what you're basically saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, is the entire world breathes the four chapters without realizing it. Ought, is, can, will. They naturally think or operate in that way, but the entire world also is caught up in the two chapters of I can and something's off and what can I do, right? Something's off, what can I do? And if that is the limited scope, regardless of Christian or non-Christian, there are things to be missed Is that correct?
Oh yeah, that's listen. You ought to be doing these podcasts. I'll drop out. That's really well. That's exactly right, because again, the fall did not erase the image of God in everyone. It effaced it. It marred it. It did not mutilate it. And so everyone goes around with unconscious notions about how to live here, how to drive this kind of a car, how to be making this kind of money, how to be married, we ought to have kids, we ought to. Unfortunately, we now live in a Darwinian world. And remember, Darwinian thought is everything is undirected material processes. And so you don't really have a soul that much. Certainly you can't talk about that. Everything just, it is what it is. Alexander Pope, he is the one who said it. He wasn't a pope. He was
just a last name, not a title.
And he said, whatever is, is. So the point is, and there have been all sorts of philosophers who, we're not going to get into it, but they have often said, you can't derive an ought from an is. In other words, life starts with, this is the way it is. What can we do about it? And without recognizing it, you're dealing with a set of assumptions that actually go all the way back to ought, but we don't live in that kind of world anymore. Fascinating study, by the way, out of MBA schools. This is 20 years old now. And it talked about that MBA graduates, they trace their language and the words they use. And one of the words that almost disappears from their language is the word ought. Because you're taught, it's leveraging, you're taught spreadsheets, you're taught management processes, you're taught what you can do to build a profitable business. You're taught Adam Smith, second book, Wealth of the Nations. And you can go out there and do very well financially. You can learn how to write code and create a tech company and crush it and make millions and have your exit strategy and be bought out and cash out and travel the world. But all of that is, you have a whole set of assumptions. And in the two-chapter gospel, those aren't teased out. What's teased out is actually Darwinian. Because in the Darwinian thought, we can't talk about what we ought to be because there is no ought. It's what Nietzsche said, might makes right. Who wins? People have the most toys, the most guns, and the most money. That's who wins. In a Darwinian world, it's just you do what can be done given what with what we have. And now, that sounds terrible and harsh in one respect. I think here's what often appears to be on the sunny side of things for people. The sunny side of things is you're making a certain amount of money and you see a nice home and you go, honey, I'm tired of renting. I want to buy a home. And the banks just give you these fabulous mortgages. They now run out to 40 plus years. See, they go, yeah, we can do that for you. We can make that affordable. And so the next thing you know, you pick off this big old mortgage. But then you walk in, oh my God, we can't cook here. That kitchen, it was renovated 15 years ago. It's inoperable. They don't say that. They say, we can't cook here. So the first thing you do is you spend a bunch of money to upgrade the whole thing. All the time, you're robbing your Peter to pay Paul. Because you're robbing where you could have been tithing the first fruits. You could have been investing in other things. You could have been saving. Oh my gosh, saving. So I hope these statistics I read, I'm a boomer, that the average boomer has saved about $25,000. It's stunning to me. If readers want to read an article, Google Neil, N-E-I-L, Gabler, G-A-B-L-E-R, and it's a story on the number of Americans who, if pressed, couldn't come up with $400, and he is one of them. And he's a successful screenwriter, but he lived way beyond his means because he could. And it's a stunning article on the percentage of Americans. I want to say it's 47%. They are so tied up in knots financially. So, Pat, I think it's worth reflecting on for serious Christians to go back to how the Old Testament closes. And it's with the prophet Malachi, whom God, through their prophet, says, "You have been robbing me." And the people say, "What do you mean robbing you?" And he goes, "In your tithes and offerings." And the point is, you spend on your lusts and desires, and then you tip me in the end. God don't live on tips. So the fourth chapter gospel goes all the way into, in my opinion, that we live in a country that has debt, public and private, and unfunded liabilities that exceed probably $20 trillion. And they're, all of these are called by any economist unsustainable. And I hardly hear a Christian ever say, "This is not the way it ought to be. What are we going to do?"
Yeah, well, I think you hit a little bit there, Mike, and you mentioned it earlier, but the consumerism that is in my mind, it just seems like this chain. And I've felt that as an American. I'm totally still blind to many aspects of it, but I think I've gotten a glimpse of it in myself, and have kind of worked through that to some extent, and just learning to recognizing more, almost a lust for things, that unquenchable fire for things, for status, for success. So that is definitely a long conversation, but I think it's also a decent segment here. The last point that maybe we can drop here is work. So I've got my keys, I've got my wallet, I've got my cell phone, I get in my car and I go to work. We don't have enough time to cover work, but I'd love to hear maybe a little bit of a teaser, if you could, if you think you can limit it to that, of work.
That's right. And on the way to work, by the way, we are being bombarded with all sorts of branding, marketing, advertising, not opposed to any of that. But again, the four chapter gospel helps us to understand that cultures foster desires and that we operate by desire. So the four chapter gospel, before we step into work and give you the teaser, goes all the way back to Psalm 115. Our God is in the heavens. He does whatever he wants to do. He does whatever he pleases. We are made in his image. The fundamental truth of human nature is we're going to do whatever we feel like doing. And so you better get your desires ordered the way they ought to be. And that is what the four chapter gospel helps us to do. It also helps us see something that is going to widen your imagination, Pat, because you and I have talked about it. And Louise Cowan, a professor at the University of Dallas, defines faith as widening the imagination. When Mary was told she was going to be pregnant, she essentially asked, "How?" In other words, she was asking the angel, she wasn't rejecting it, she was saying, "Widen my imagination. How does this work?" In the same way, we're going to talk about work in our next time, and I'm going to widen your imagination, because the four chapter gospel, as you just alluded to, starts with why. As Simon Sinek in his famous TED talk said, start with why. And when you start with why, the reason fundamentally we work is to be a prepared bride, the bride of Christ, so that we have dirt under our fingernails, just as he has dirt under his fingernails. he doesn't want to come to the wedding banquet and ask his wife, "So, did you enjoy cultivating the earth?" And she goes, "What?"